Turkey, check. Mashed potatoes and gravy, check. Cranberry sauce, got it. Preparing for a big Thanksgiving feast always comes with a long to-do list, but just when you think it's under control, you'd better add one item and underline it several times because you're going to need a plan for talking to relatives about the recent election. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I can't help you with your turkey. But today, on KCUR Central Standard, we're getting ideas for talking effectively about race, religion, and politics with the people you care about. Our guest is Susan Wilson. She's a longtime KCUR contributor and the Vice Chancellor of Diversity and Inclusion for UMKC. She's also a psychologist, so she covers a lot of bases on this topic. Hi, Susan. Thanks so much for coming in.
Good morning, Gina. My pleasure.
One of the things we've been realizing is that a lot of us live in safe little bubbles where we mostly interact with people who agree with us. So does it seem kind of funny to you that our own families might be the places where we're most likely to encounter people who aren't like us politically?
Well, yes, because you kind of think about family as shared ideals and, you know, shared history. And so isn't it logical to think that they might have the same shared views, but more and more often this is not the case. And it's common for families to have diametrically opposed political views.
Do you think that this year's election gets at more personal kinds of divisions than we're used to in politics? The divisions feel more personal to me.
Yes, I think this election has really brought out, in some instances, the worst on both sides. I mean, just the election itself and in some ways the lack of civility, the name calling, although this is more and more true of elections in general. Now, we just are living in a society where civility is less prized than it used to be. But I think because America seems to be, at least if you believe the polls, so deeply divided, that this election has really brought out division.
Do you think that the subject areas where people are at least seeming to disagree have something to do with that? I mean, a lot of it is around identity politics, and who you are is personal, and then who you are with respect to your family is even more personal.
Well, I just think there were a lot of hot button issues involved in this election, whether you're talking about immigration and building walls, whether you're talking about an endorsement by the White Nationalist Party, which portends for some people who are people of color that this administration may not be sensitive to their issues. Or whether you're talking about women's issues and whether or not certain types of behaviors are okay. There were just a lot of hot button issues to go around this time.
What are you seeing on the UMKC campus as far as how people are handling conversations with people who either don't agree with them or who they believe don't agree with them?
Well, some would say that university campuses are bastions of liberalism. Some people believe that, but in fact, there are quite a bit of differences on university campuses. And in fact, that's what makes them kind of vibrant learning places, because if everyone thought the same, there wouldn't be much to learn. Certainly, I think among students, last week there were a number of listening sessions that were held just for students to process the election, and there was a range of responses. We had some students in tears who were some of our DACA students and some of the Latino students who really then worry about what a Trump presidency would mean to maybe parents who are here in the country illegally, or perhaps to them who were brought there when they were children. Some of our Muslim students communicated the idea that they don't even want to go outside now because they fear that the hijab that they wear is an easy target, and that somehow the Trump presidency has given people license who are bigoted to do bigoted things and to attack them. And of course, African American students who are in a sense of shock and a fear that the clock is going to be turned back on civil rights, particularly given the law that passed here in Missouri, the voter ID law, which seems to kind of fly in the face of voters' rights.
Are students who perhaps supported Trump, do they have fears of their own that you've heard about?
Well, I think we have heard that some of those students who supported Trump feel like that there's not really a place for them. sometimes that they're afraid to express their views that they were pro-Trump for fear of being lashed out against or attacked. And so they just stay silent. So many of them kind of feel silenced. And I think part of the role of a university is to make a place for everyone, regardless of what their views are, to be able to express those views. But what I hear from some of our Trump-supporting students is they don't always feel like there's a place.
Do you think that part of what's going on right now is that there is a conversation? There's a conversation happening, but where people, like when you talk about people being silent, where we're only hearing kind of one side of it, depending on who we are and who we affiliate with.
Well, for example, the students and some adults that I've talked to who feel silenced, who are Trump supporters, say that one of the things that really irks them is that people portray them as being racist or misogynistic just because they supported Trump. And they make a point to say, hey, I'm not racist. I'm not misogynistic. But I just thought he was the better man for the job. Given the two candidates that we have, and that I think that his business acumen will do well for our country. And I think there are people who are blue collar and working class who feel like they have not made progress under previous administrations. But again, I think those voices feel a bit silenced now in the shock and awe that is happening with other people who did not support Trump.
We'll get on to family in a second, but it is interesting to me that on the one hand, you have people who feel silenced, and on the other hand, the call that you're hearing from the left largely is if it wasn't because of these views having to do with race and religion that you cast your vote in this way, now is the time to speak up and say, I denounce that. So you have on the one hand a call for outspokenness, and on the other hand, emotions that lead to silence.
Well, yes. And I think everybody right now is in a watchful waiting period. I think people on the left or left moderate are looking for signs and signals that it's not going to be bad as they really think it is with regard to women's rights, rights for people of color, and immigration. And I guess the signals about who some of the appointments are kind of continuing to echo the idea that maybe these appointments aren't attuned to all America. You know, on the other hand, on the other side, there's the idea that, well, why wouldn't you put people in place who are loyal to you in your campaign? That's what all presidents do. And so this is no different.
Well, against this backdrop, families are going to come together and perhaps really strongly disagree. And I suspect that some families will handle that by avoiding the topic of politics altogether. But do you think that it's truly avoidable this year?
I think it's going to be tough. And when you think about what happens at Thanksgiving anyway, I mean, when you think about what happens, I mean, as psychologists, every year, I remember when I was practicing, someone would ask me to do a workshop on how to get through the holidays, because holidays are a hotbed of emotion anyway.
Why?
Well, I
think it seems so simple.
I think that, you know, when you talk about families, families have history. There's always the people that feel left out or not included. There's historic patterns in families that have to do with sibling relationships, what did or didn't go wrong earlier on, and some of those feelings that are still carried forward. And then the holiday itself, because we've bought into this myth that holidays should look like a Hallmark card and with happy families gathered together. But no family is perfect. Uncle John has an alcohol problem. Aunt Mary just got divorced and is inconsolable. So real families have real life problems that all come to the fore at the Thanksgiving table.
With some of the issues that we just brought up that are in the air politically, I mean, disagreeing is always hard, but it's extra hard, I think, when you possibly feel like not only does your family not get you, but perhaps they don't have your back. Maybe, you know, that there could be a really deeply psychologically unsettling component this year to a political disagreement, even if it just has to do with your perception of why people disagree with you, separate from reality.
Well, and you use the word perception, and I think perception is really something that plays into all of this. And I think it's one of the principles that people, if they want to have good constructive conversations, that they have to keep in mind is our perceptions may or may not be reality. And that one of the things that you have to kind of do is put your perceptions to the side, even though that's hard, and try to deal with the person as they are and the humanity of the person. But often our perceptions are so strong, it's very difficult for us to do that.
Yeah, it seems like a very easier said than done kind of thing. I want to also just address that you would think that on something where if these are issues of race or religion, I mean, I think there was a time when maybe a lot of people would assume, well, you would share those things with your family. But we live in a really complicated reality. I mean, people often are in the same family who aren't from the same racial or religious background. How do you talk about how your perceptions of what just happened in this election might be very, very different based on not just how you vote, but who you are?
Well, I think the only way to talk about it is from your particular standpoint. Too often when we have these conversations, we're doing some finger pointing. We're talking about those people and you over there, when all you can really talk about is your truth and how you perceive something and what you believe. That's a starting point. You have to come to dialogue based on your own description of who you are.
Okay, so let's say we're brave, we're going to do this. First step in my mind is this issue of politeness. Do you think that it matters to be polite when you're having a conversation about a really heated political issue? I mean, you're a guest in someone's home, probably, or else they are a guest in your home. And it's generally considered incredibly impolite to challenge someone when you are a guest or their host or a fellow guest.
Well, first of all, I think different families have different rules about what's polite. So I don't think that there's one standard of politeness, having come from both an Italian and African-American background. I can tell you there's a lot of lively conversation that goes on in a non-political season where people are challenging each other, but it's not really considered impolite. It's just what we do. But I think that you want to disagree without being disagreeable.
Explain how one does that.
Well, you want to keep it non-personal. It's one thing for me to say, I'm just not sure that Trump is going to do a great job for our country. It's one thing for me to say that. It's another thing for me to say, Gina, you're dumb because you voted for Trump. The difference is I'm making it personal. I'm name calling. You know, I'm really casting judgment upon you. And I think anytime you do that, then you're going to have an argument that sometimes is difficult to control.
A lot of people on the left are saying that it's your obligation, if you are a progressive, to call out racism. But there's also this article that's been making the rounds that says there are ways to address racism effectively and that calling someone a racist isn't one of those ways. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree. I mean, anytime you, first of all, when you use the word racist too much, it really loses its meaning. And if you use it for anything and everything, I mean, it starts to lose its meaning. I think any kind of name calling stops the conversation. It's a conversation stopper. And really, I think what we should be really doing right now is trying to learn from each other. I just had a conversation Saturday night with someone who was a Trump supporter. I approached that conversation with curiosity and interest.
And so I guess we're establishing that perhaps you are not a Trump supporter. I feel the need to just not assume that, who we all are.
And right. But what I'm saying is when you are talking with someone who may not hold the same views, you know, pulling back and getting your personal feelings out of it and approaching it with curiosity and interest, you know, exploring, well, why did someone feel like they voted for that candidate? What did that mean to them? But often we jump in with our own personal views and our own feelings. And that's another thing I would underscore here is feelings.
Yeah. What's the role of feelings in a conversation like this? Because on the one hand, our feelings are what humanize us. But sometimes when we get really emotional, it discredits us.
Well, it's true. And I think, first of all, when we're talking politics, which was the cardinal rule, wasn't it? You don't come to work talking about politics or religion. And those are impolite subjects, but they're hard to avoid right now. But I think if we all go into this holiday season knowing that when we're talking politics, there's going to be some emotions attached. Now, as you said, emotions can be good. They make us who we are, but they can also derail us. And so when we find ourselves becoming too emotional, that's when we're more likely to become blaming or shaming or judging or, you know, looking at the other person in a very pejorative way.
You know, what do you think is a reasonable goal when you're talking to your loved ones about politics? Because it seems like knowing why you're having the conversation in the first place might help you have it more productively. But winning seems like a lofty goal.
Well, I would just say if you go into any of these conversations with the idea about who's right and who's wrong and I'm going to win this conversation, you're already dead in the water. Because really the way that you should be going into the conversation, your goal should be to learn. And often our goal isn't to learn from each other. It's to, you know, make a point about who's right and who's wrong. And I think the other piece is really respect. You know, coming into the dialogue with a healthy sense of respect that we're two human beings and we have a right to our own opinions. And history will show ultimately which way, if you will, it was a better way. But right now we're in the moment, and if we're going to have a dialogue, it needs to be a respectful one.
What about people who do feel, though, like their core values are in some way violated by a stance on the opposite side of the aisle from them? You know what I mean? Like, if I feel like something that is just a core to my understanding of what it means to, like, be a good person. I mean, there are people who feel that way right now. What about them? How do they approach this conversation?
Well, I think to understand that you're not going to solve the problem in a conversation. If you feel that your morals and your values have been deeply offended in some way, then it's better to find some constructive action that you can take in your community to address those things. But you're not going to solve that in a conversation. And perhaps if you come into it thinking that, you'll just end up feeling frustrated and even more angry.
So knowing the limits of just conversation.
Right.
So much of this is going to differ based on your role within your family. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that all families have various roles. And sometimes there are role reversals in families. It's very interesting to watch. But I think certainly if you're a so-called elder in the family, that people often look to you with a lot of respect and your opinion really counts. But also that can backfire. I mean, then some of the younger members of the family can say, you know what, I'm not going to talk to him or her. They're really old school and their views don't represent mine. I mean, I know of some people I know who have started to challenge certain elders in the family, particularly around racial issues, like when that elder says something racially insensitive or uses wording that is insensitive, the N-word or other words, and people who stand up and say, look, you might want to say that when I'm not here, but while I'm here, that's offensive to me. And sometimes those conversations go well, and sometimes the whole thing blows up. You just never know.
Tell me about your family. How do you think your own Thanksgiving is going to go this year?
Well, in full transparency, my dad was a Teamster. My family has been solidly Democratic for years and years. So I don't expect there to be a lot of controversy. Now, every once in a while, there'll be a guest or two that have a different point of view, but our family invites healthy discussion, and we seem to be able to do that without getting at odds with each other. So
about things other than politics, I'm guessing, if you're all solidly in kind of one camp.
Well, even when you're within one camp, there's still differences about philosophy, about implementation of certain rules. For example, there might be some people in my family who say, well, you know, maybe the immigrant thing has gotten out of hand, and others who say that's really stupid. So even within families, there's within-group diversity.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll take your questions at 816-235-2888, and we'll hear more from Susan Wilson about what to do if political debates do escalate beyond your comfort level this Thanksgiving. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. Susan Wilson, welcome back to KCUR Central Standard.
Well, thank you, Gina Kaufman.
I am Gina Kaufman, and we're talking about bridging political divides across the dinner table this Thanksgiving, or trying to, anyway. Susan, what if the conversation doesn't go well? Because, you know, as much as we might be preparing for the calm, learning-oriented, open-hearted discussion you've been advising, you really never know what's going to happen. Do you have advice for how to cope if things really go south?
Well, two things even before we go there. You know, one of the things I forgot to mention is holidays often remind us if we've had a recent death in the family, people are grieving and are emotional about that. And also to the extent that we're drinking a little wine or spirits, sometimes that can lower inhibitions and people get a little bit more, let's say, liberated and raucous in how they present certain information. And so I think in most families, there usually is someone who is kind of the peacemaker or the mediator. Maybe that person should go into Thanksgiving kind of on standby, that if things get out of hand, that they stand ready to kind of say, now, come on. And really, I think number one is when things get out of hand is to remind people why we're here together. It's the reason for the holiday, which is, you know, family togetherness. We don't see each other often. Let's enjoy the time that we have. And let's maybe, if it gets too heated, let's not talk about politics. Let's find other things that we can talk about that we more agree on.
What do you think? I mean, I guess that raises the interesting question of how you know when this particular conversation is over. Because people can also disagree about that. You know, there's the person who wants to keep going, and there's the person who wants to preserve the peace, I guess. And in the interest of that, we'll try to, you know, call a time limit. How do you resolve that?
Well, I mean, first of all, you know when it's going too far out of hand, when voices are raised and it starts to get personal and there's some finger pointing and name calling. That's way out of hand.
You don't think that can be healthy, or maybe, I don't know, you don't think that breakthroughs can happen in that territory?
I think spirited dialogue, yes, but when it starts getting personal and people start feeling wounded and hurt, the point of the conversation is not to wound and hurt other people. So when it gets to that level, and the person that wants to keep going, that's when you take that person aside and say, look, let's talk about other things. The other tip is if you already know your family and you know they're pretty polarized, maybe you want to do some structured activities. Maybe you want to play games or you want to bring out the photo albums and go down memory lane and try to upfront avoid some of these conversations if you know that your family has a history of not doing well with conflict.
Let's talk to Russ. Russ is joining us from Pleasant Hill at 816-235-2888. Hi, Russ.
Hello. Yeah, I just thought I'd interject that, I do believe in the importance of family, there comes a point at which a blood or marital relations must take a second place to one's life and how one chooses to run it. If things become too toxic on a regular basis, it might be time to write a particular person off. It's one thing to be challenged. It's another thing to be exposing oneself continually to a poisonous or otherwise just generally unpleasant influence. And unfortunately, politics and or economic theory can often breed a level of contempt and dislike that that transcends any familial ties. I mean, I don't feel guilty about separating steaks from the same animal when I buy only one of them at a grocery store. And part of not being a colony of sponges is that we can choose where we live and with whom we associate. I'll take my answer via FM. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Russ.
Well, Russ does make a good point. There are family situations that I'm aware of and was aware of when I was practicing as a psychologist that truly are toxic. It could be because of the family history and some dysfunction that occurred there, or it could be, quite frankly, because one part of the family does hold views that can be toxic to another element of the family. And so there is a point, I agree with Russ, if you're going into a family situation where you feel attacked, where you feel like chronically upset because of things that are said or done, then maybe it is time for you to choose to go someplace else for Thanksgiving. And there are family situations that just are that toxic. That's not every family. Those are the outliers. But there are those situations.
Do you think that politics have gotten to that level of toxicity? I mean, is it possible right now to disagree really, really strongly about politics and still feel okay about each other? Because to look at headlines, it feels like the answer is no. But obviously, you know, I think that what you've been expressing is the hope that family can transcend that.
Well, it goes back to how families solve conflicts. You know, some families solve conflicts by not speaking to each other. Other families solve conflicts by having a big, raucous, ugly argument. So I think the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. And so if your family doesn't have a good history of solving conflicts, and if there are polar opposites that become very attacking, then that's a clue that this political season is not going to go very well for your family either.
Well, we're going to be going to break pretty soon, but I want to ask you how, like, just taking the temperature there on the UMKC campus, do you think that people are wanting these conversations more than ever or dreading them more than ever? Maybe both?
I think there's some of both. I think for our campus, we kept getting messages that people want to have conversations. But I think there's also a fear that the conversations will get out of hand. And that's why we've been structuring the conversations. You know, we have facilitators who can help help students and others wade through those conversations so that they don't become out of hand.
Susan Wilson, Vice Chancellor of Diversity and Inclusion at UMKC, thanks for joining us. I hope your Thanksgiving goes smoothly.
And yours as well.
We'll be following up on this conversation the Monday after Thanksgiving, where we'll hear how it went. I'm Gina Kaufman. When KCUR Central Standard returns, a local opera singer finds a kindred soul in a 17th century composer. That's next. That singing you hear is Victoria Botero. She's Kansas City's unofficial avant-garde soprano, but she's also classically trained, and in between experimental projects like the one you're hearing, she performs a classical repertoire. Right now, she's preparing for a Baroque program featuring music by a 17th century composer by the name of Barbara Strozzi. I'll let Victoria tell you Barbara's story. Hi, Victoria.
Hi, Gina. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
So you were recently on a residency in Milan.
Yes.
And during this residency, first of all, what brought you to Milan? What was it that you were there to do?
Well, I applied for the Leighton International Artist Exchange Program, and I was grateful to receive a grant to travel to Milan to really explore the work of this composer named Barbara Strozzi, who was from Venice. She's a 17th
century. You
say that
much more nicely than I do.
You know, I'm lucky. I studied Italian in college, and I've kind of been obsessed with the language and the music and the people since then. So I've lived there off and on since I was in my early 20s.
Why did you want to study this particular composer?
I came across her about 7 years ago. I was looking for completely different repertoire. I was looking for music from the Spanish Baroque for a program that I work a lot with, Beau Bledsoe, who's a classical guitarist. And as I was doing my research, I came across this name, Barbara Strozzi, which was unusual because you don't see a lot of women composers, particularly from the Baroque era. So I kind of put aside my search for the Spanish Baroque and started diving into her music. And what I found was just an incredible amount of music. She was the most published composer of her era, male or female. And she was a soprano. So basically, she was writing for my kind of voice. So it was an immediate connection with how she wrote for the voice and the kind of texts that she set.
What do you mean by how she wrote for the voice?
Well, you know, mostly I sing music that's written by men for a woman's voice. And I saw the way that she wrote, and she understood how the soprano voice moves. There are different parts of our range where you need to be careful in terms of how you use vowels or how you use language. And then she also really understands how to exploit the really beautiful part of our sounds, right in the passaggio and moving forward. Those are technical terms for classical singing. But she knows how the voice opens up and then to exploit the lower part of our range where it's fuller and richer.
When you talk about that there are things that you have to be careful of when you're a soprano, certain vowel sounds, careful or else what?
Oh, well, it can come out kind of ugly or the word doesn't make any sense. You know, in the higher part of our range, it tends to be more beautiful, but it's a little harder to understand the text. So you put more of the sort of the meaningful, the words that carry a lot of meaning lower in the range, in the what we think of in our speaking range, and then the more expressive sounds higher in the range.
So you discovered this woman who's a composer. She's composed really a huge amount of music, and you've never heard of her before. I mean, that seems odd.
Well, you know, I did a degree in musicology here at UMKC at the conservatory, and I found that's actually really common. In the history of music, there have been eras where composers are incredibly famous for their time, and then they fall out of fashion and they totally disappear. And I'm always interested in that, and like, why was something so important in this era, but now at this point we don't look at this music? What if we went back and looked at it? Is there something that they're saying that they were saying then that's still relevant to us now? And there's actually another composer on this program I'm doing on December 4th that's kind of the same idea, Benedetto Ferrari. He was super famous in his time in Venice. He opened one of the first opera houses, but he's completely disappeared. In fact, none of his music has been, there are no modern editions. So I actually took the manuscripts and created modern editions, which we'll be using on our program coming up in a few weeks.
So when you went to Milan, I know that part of what intrigued you about Barbara Strozzi was her personal story as well. Did you already know her personal story?
When I went to Milan, yes, I already knew some background about it.
Share that with us.
Sure. She was the illegitimate daughter of a nobleman who formally adopted her when she was 10, and he educated her to be a musician and to be a singer. Now, her father, Giulio Strozzi, he was an intellectual as well as being a nobleman, and he hosted these salons in his house with all of the intellectuals of Venice. And starting at the age of 15, maybe earlier, she was invited to sit in on these discussions and to perform, to sing some of her compositions. And then eventually he created a salon just for her where she was leading the discussion. She would create the topic of discussion where the artists and poets philosophers of the day would come to her home, and she would say, well, let's talk about this topic. And then at some point she would break and she would perform a piece, often set to the text or poem by somebody in the room.
But I guess when I'm thinking about her personal story, I'm thinking about there was a whisper campaign against her.
Ah, yes. So, as I said, her life was unusual. There weren't many women sitting in with a bunch of the leading intellectual men of the day. So shortly after she started to perform and to lead these discussions, there were these satires, slanderous satires, that were published about her that indicated that, well, of course, she must be a courtesan, which would be a sort of high-class prostitute. She was exchanging sexual favors in order for the support of these men. And then, you know, her personal life is murky. We don't know a lot about it. We do know that she had four children, and she never married. She had four children with Giovanni Vidman, who was already married. He had a family. Now, at the same time that these satires were being published indicating she was a courtesan and that she had this relationship with Giovanni Vidman, there's also another letter that was published at that time that indicated that she may have been raped. So it's unknown what her situation was. What's clear is that she made the best of probably a lack of choice in her time. It's possible that her relationship was coerced with Giovanni Vidman. He was her father's age, so he's significantly older than her. Perhaps after she had that first child, she realized that maybe her best choice was to stay with him, to continue the relationship. She had two, we're not sure if the fourth child was his as well, probably. But regardless, she was composing constantly. I mean, I look at the output of what she created in her life, and it's extraordinary. There is, I just don't see how she would have had time to be a courtesan in addition to raising four children and being the most published composer of her era. It seems a little odd.
You are a mother and a singer and, you know, juggle different demands on your time as well. Do you think that part of how you respond to hearing this story has to do with, like, kind of reaching across time and into another continent and maybe seeing, just understanding that, yeah, understanding something about her that other people might not?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, on a personal note, I'm a single mother. I have one child. I have a little boy. He's five. And, you know, I'm a full-time musician. And I have a dishwasher, you know, like I have modern conveniences. But I find myself just strapped for time to find time to practice. And I don't compose. So, you know, when I looked at her story, I thought, well, I know when she's writing music. She's writing music when the kids are asleep. She's writing music when she has somebody who can take care of them for a moment. I mean, it takes real concentration to make music. So yeah, there's definitely, I definitely have an empathy and a sympathy for her life story. And also, you know, gosh, it's 2016 and we're still hearing slander about women who are making headway into the world of men. So it just seems like looking back 400 years ago, it seems fair to perform her music now, not just because it's really extraordinary music, but the life is worth talking about.
When you went to Milan, was it her life that you were studying? What was it that you were able to access in Milan about this music that you couldn't quite come in contact with from here?
I didn't go there to study her life per se. It was really to study her music and the performance practice. The style of her music is significantly different than the classical era, the opera era, which is how I was trained initially. So I went to Milan. I worked with a lutenist named Paul Beyer, and we had a consort of early music musicians, and really discussed how the music should sound. It shouldn't have a lot of vibrato in it. It shouldn't be super legato, like a Puccini line, which I love.
What does legato mean?
Legato is really smooth singing where all of the notes connect together. In the Baroque era, there's something called inegal, unequal. Not every note is equal. And the reason they're not equal is because each note has its own individual meaning, and it's supposed to carry the meaning of the word. So what I learned more than anything being in Milan was how important the text was. And I actually spent almost as much time looking at the words and understanding what's behind them. Because once I figured out what the text meant, then the music part became a lot easier. Then it seemed natural how I should phrase, how the notes should be equal or unequal.
Was there a particular phrase that where you really worked with it for a while and kind of, I don't know, where you can explain to us what the phrase means and how that contributes to the way you sing it?
Oh, gosh, I'm thinking of a piece which we're doing on our concert called Che si può fare. And it's like an opera in 8 minutes. And it opens, Che si può fare means, you know, what can you do? What can I do? And to me, it's the moment that a heart breaks, and that's where the music starts. And it's this moment of like utter desolation and emptiness. And the line is, it's just this aching sound. And how do you imbue the sound of the voice with that? With that emotion and into the words. And she repeats them over and over again, which is unusual for her music. She's usually, she wants to get to the next phrase and to develop the idea. But this opening part of this aria, she just, like, you can't, when you can't get past this pain, and you just repeat the phrase over and over again, and that's how the song starts.
Does knowing her biography affect how you make these decisions about, you know, how you're understanding the lyrics and the music and how they should fuse? Or does the biography of the composer not, I mean, do you need to connect to the other human being who's written the music?
I like to connect to the human being, but I don't think it's necessary to understand her music. It just happens to be really interesting. I find her biography does tell me why she sets the text that she does. And really, it's the biography part of it is that she was surrounded by intellectuals. She was writing for really smart people, and the text reveals that. Like, in contrast, the music by Ferrari, he's writing for the public. So his music is not as detailed in terms of the text, but she was writing for people who really understood and spent a lot of time with philosophical ideas.
How did you get into opera?
PBS.
Really?
I blame public television. Yeah, I was 12 years old, and I was watching TV, flipping channels, and my sister tells this story, so I know it's true. And I just turned on PBS, and there were people running around a stage, and they're wearing big costumes, and they were singing, and I thought, oh my gosh, that's it, that's what I want to do. They're singing, they're acting, and they're wearing great clothes. I am in.
The style of singing in opera is, you know, I think not everybody is drawn to that, and I wonder if you can explain what it is about opera that sings to you especially. I mean, not just singing, but singing in this style.
Mm-hmm. To me, the reason we sing, like as humans, is because the words are not enough. That the music starts the moment when just saying the words, we have to sing them. So I find, I mean, that's the reason for singing. But then I also really love it because it's hard. And I love challenges. And I love to train my voice. It's something I've been fascinated by for, you know, since I was 12 years old.
What do you think that people who don't, you know an opera singer might not understand about that process of training your voice to do these things? Because it does seem like sort of the vocal equivalent of maybe an athlete or something, just taking the body that we all have and doing something outside the ordinary realm with it.
Right. Well, actually, what you just said is what I want people to know, that it is an athletic event. I think a lot of people who are not familiar with classical singing and with opera think that you're just born with that voice. And I can tell you from personal experience, no, I was not. I was not the best. I just really wanted it really badly. So I practiced a lot, and I'm grateful to have had and still have an extraordinary voice teacher that guided me. It's something like a passion that you have that then develops into just your job. Like you've got to do it every day. You have to practice. You have to take care of your body and your spirit in order to get on stage and perform.
How do you take care of your voice?
I drink a lot of water. I discovered swimming again a few months ago, so that's been really helpful for breath control.
Whoa.
Yeah, and it's just good for you, too. So singers, we can't, unlike our rock and roll sidekicks, there's some things we can't do. We can't smoke. We can't drink too much. So it's it is a healthy lifestyle.
You seem to cross over boundaries between the world of classical repertoire and as we were saying earlier in the show, experimental stuff. You seem to cross-pollinate with artists in a lot of different media, visual artists, dancers. How did you come to fill this role in Kansas City's artistic community?
I think Kansas City did it to me. I think we live in such a great city. If I lived in a larger community, I don't think that I would be able to collaborate with as many people as I do. I would say it started maybe about 10 years ago when I started working with Bo Bledsoe. We did a concert together, and then he introduced me to some of his colleagues, like Brad Cox, who's a composer with the Owen Cox Dance Group. Brad wrote some music that I did, and then just through getting to know the community, we're pretty tight here. All of the musicians, you know, that within the classical world, jazz world, we all kind of know each other. And then the visual artists, dancers, we all just like work, play, and live together. So when someone has a project, then like, oh, who do I know? Oh, I'll just pull her in. So I'm grateful.
Are you surprised by how often it seems that people who do like more popular music type styles want to bring in an opera singer for some special moment?
Yes, I am. I'm like, are you sure you want this? But, you know, I can also, I can change the sound to the needs of the project. Like that that piece that you played right at the top of this segment. That I wouldn't call that my straight up opera voice or the voice that I, you know, use for early music. I have to adapt the sounds to the needs of the composer, and that's my job.
So when you approach, like, you've got this program coming up in just a couple of weeks that brought you here today. When you approach a project, how much do you think about the audience in terms of how you're going to deliver? I mean, does the audience change anything for you?
Oh, yeah. I think about the audience all the time, just as the composers did. I think about what would be interesting to them. This program is all in Italian. There will probably be a few Italian speakers, but I'll be speaking before each piece to explain why this piece of music is so interesting.
Victoria Botero will be performing La Serenissima, was that right?
Yes.
With her ensemble on December 4th at the 1900 building downtown. Victoria, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Gina.
You can listen back to this discussion at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. We'll also have our conversation there about political discussions at the Thanksgiving table. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Sign up for our podcast while you're there. Tomorrow, a few different art exhibits around town are featuring Cuban culture, which is more accessible now than ever. Talk to us tomorrow about your connections with Kansas City's Cuban and Afro-Latino community. That's tomorrow at 10. You can talk to us on Twitter anytime. We're @KCURCST. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, and Andrea Tudhope. Our interns are Aaron Pelish and Raven Brooks. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.